Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear stories from Anna Mateo, Jonathan Evans, and Katie Weaver. But first, Dorothy Gundy brings us this report.
The application process to almost every college and university in the United States has several parts to it. Each part tells admissions officials at the schools something different about an applicant. Class grades can show the subjects a student is strong in, for example. A list of the student's activities outside of school can show what his or her interests are. But Seth Walker says nothing really tells the story of an applicant as well as the essay or personal statement. Walker is with Indiana University, a public university in Bloomington, Indiana. He is the school's associate director of international admissions.
The essay is a short written statement that almost every college and university in the U.S. requires of applicants. In it, students are expected to write about themselves and express their personal opinions about an issue. Walker says the statement helps admissions officers answer questions they may have about a given student. Maybe your grades dropped a little bit, or maybe you stopped a class halfway through the year, he told VOA. The essay or the personal statement can be an opportunity, if the school wants it, to explain that, if you don't think the school will get that explanation through a letter of recommendation, or something like that. But what goes into a good essay?
Walker notes that every school has its own way of looking at the essay. Some schools will ask an applicant a very specific question. Others will let the student choose between different subjects or simply write about anything they want. Generally speaking, there is no one perfect way to write an essay, Walker says. He says that given a choice, students should choose to write about an issue they care about. This could be about a difficult time when they were growing up or a meaningful relationship they had. However, they should also be careful about the subject they choose. We'll read the same essays a lot, said Walker. We'll read how a parent is a hero and you want to be just like that hero. We read a lot about your sports team or some other difficult experience that you've gone through, maybe learning a different language. Those are all great topics and great essays to write. But you have to remember that a lot of people write those essays. So you have to write about them in a creative way.
Walker notes that schools have an easy time recognizing when students try to write about something they think admissions officials want to see in an essay. And even in cases where students cannot choose the subject, schools can tell when students are writing in a way to make their essay seem more appealing. For example, Walker notes, many students think that telling a sad story makes them easy to remember. But that is not necessarily what admissions officials want to see, he says. What they want is an essay about anything that is truly special or important to the student, and which also shows their better qualities. In addition, it should show the student's understanding of the world and what their experiences or way of thinking will bring to the school. Walker admits that getting started in the writing process can be difficult. That is why he says students should remember that schools are not expecting them to sit down and write an essay with little or no preparation. In fact, students should give themselves plenty of time for planning, writing, and rewriting. Most important of all, students should just start with a simple idea and slowly expand that into a full essay, he says.
Starting very small is always great, because I think if you sit down in front of a computer with the purpose to write your entire essay without anything else, it'll be very overwhelming, said Walker. So start from the small building blocks and go from there. He suggests keeping things simple, especially because of the rules most schools have for the essay. Many colleges and universities ask applicants to limit their essays to between 500 and 1,000 words. It is also better when students stay focused on one subject and not include unrelated details. For example, if a student writes about a time they served as the leader of an organization, the writer should not describe difficulties in a class. Schools often take into consideration whether or not English is a student's native language, Walker adds. Reading one's own writing, especially out loud, can help an applicant recognize mistakes. Also, having someone else read it can help, leading to the removal of unnecessary or unrelated parts of the essay. And hearing someone else read your writing out loud can also help you decide if the way the ideas are expressed is really what you want to say.
So, Walker says, applicants should make use of the many resources available to them. In the U.S., many students work on their college essays with English teachers and fellow students during their last 2 years of high school. He suggests that students have parents, friends, and even special writing services help them work on their essays. Also, students should consider rewriting the statement at least once to improve it. However, Walker does note one concern he has about students involving other people in the process. At American colleges and universities, doing one's own work is extremely important. If a school learns a student has asked or paid someone else to write an essay for them, that school will likely remove the student from their study program. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.
Now, the VOA Learning English program, Words and Their Stories. There are several kinds of citrus fruit. The most common are limes, oranges, grapefruit, tangerines, and lemons. Out of all of them, it is the lemon that has found its way into a number of English language expressions. While eating an orange or grapefruit can be pleasant, we don't usually eat plain lemons. Lemons are really sour. The acid in them makes it really hard to eat them raw. Lemons are so acidic, they can actually take the protective enamel off your teeth. So, biting into a lemon does not bring a smile to your face. In fact, when someone is unhappy, she may have a puckered look on her face. In this case, we can say she looks as if she just sucked on a lemon. We can also call this person a sourpuss. This is a person who always complains and always looks unhappy. With its really sour taste, sucking on a lemon is unpleasant. So telling someone to go suck a lemon is a way of showing your anger. It's not really nice and sounds childish, but there are worse things you could say. While we don't usually eat lemons raw, they can add taste and vitamin C to food and drinks. But in everyday speech, the word lemon usually represents something poor, bad, or broken. For example, if you hand someone a lemon, you have given them something that is broken or doesn't work. This expression means that you have cheated them. A lemon can also mean an unsatisfactory answer. As we said, a lemon can be something you bought that does not work. It is defective. Americans often use the word lemon to describe a newly bought but defective vehicle. Let's say you go to an automotive dealership and buy what you think is a good car. On the streets around the dealership, it runs perfectly. But on the drive home, everything goes wrong. The gas pedal sticks. The engine starts smoking. Then it just stops running in the middle of the road. You have bought a lemon. As you watch the tow truck take away the car for repairs, you call the dealership and demand your money back. The salesman says with a laugh, "No way. All sales are final." Now, many people would get angry. Not only do you not have a car, but you have lost a lot of money. But you don't get upset. You find a way to make this situation work for you. After all, you are a person who looks on the bright side. Your life's belief is, when life gives you lemons, you make lemonade. Here, the term lemon means a problem or difficulty in life. Lemonade is a cool, refreshing drink. You could say it is the prize you get by overcoming difficulty with your good attitude. So we use this expression to describe a situation where something goes wrong, but the person in the situation chooses to turn it into a positive experience. People who turn lemons into lemonade, we call optimistic. They have a can-do attitude. This is a common phrase, and we use it in many different situations. Sometimes we don't even need to say the whole thing. If you simply say, "When life gives you lemons," people will know what you mean. So, back to our broken car story. You take the lemon of a car you bought at the dealership, and you make lemonade. First, you learn about your rights as a buyer under a measure known as the Lemon Law. In the United States, this requires an automobile manufacturer or dealer to replace, repair, or refund the cost of an automobile that proves to be defective after purchase. Under the Lemon Law, you will get your money back. But don't stop there. Why make a glass of lemonade when you can make a whole pitcher? You warn friends and neighbors about that car dealership. You write an article for the local newspaper about lemon laws. The newspaper receives many emails and letters from people who had similar experiences. Knowing their rights, they also demand their money back for the lemons that were sold to them. The newspaper is so happy with the amount of responses that it offers you a part-time job writing stories about consumer issues. You've turned a bad experience into something good, and you've helped others. Life gave you lemons, and you made lemonade. And that's the end of this week's Words and Their Stories. I'm Ana Mateo.
China observers have expressed support for a new Chinese government policy on land and property rights. The proposal calls for permitting Chinese villagers to rent out their homes and farms. China experts say this could increase development and ease tensions in rural China, especially in areas ignored by the government. The observers say a growing number of houses are empty in rural areas as people move to cities. Chinese officials released the policy document earlier this month. It said the government would ease controls on rights for rural land and unused housing. As a result, it said, people who moved to cities could permit development of their properties or rent out their homes. The policy could affect people unhappy with rural life. They could move but still earn money from their properties, said China expert Wasana Wangsurawat. Urban centers are growing, while the quality of life in rural areas has not improved, leading to growing dissatisfaction, she told the Thomson Reuters Foundation. She said the new policy may be a way to deal with that and persuade more people to move to the cities. Wasana Wangsurawat is an assistant professor at Chulalongkorn University in Bangkok. Almost 59% of China's population already lives in urban areas. Continued development is important to the government's plans for growth. China is the world's second largest economy. Chinese land is divided into urban and rural land regimes. The government has ownership rights over urban land, while rural land is owned collectively and cannot be bought and sold freely. China began to examine its land use policies in 2014. The government's decision to ease controls on land falls far short of creating an open market. But observers said it is an early move in a major reform process. It is significant as a step forward to liberalize land rights, said Dan Wong of the Economist Intelligence Unit Research Group. She said the change in policy, if followed by other rule changes, may help influence businesses to develop very large farms. She said, if this round of land reform turns out to be successful, it will change the landscape of rural China greatly in terms of forms of employment, agricultural organization, and even social structures. She noted that the reforms could be weakened if farmland is seized for industrial use or to grow for-profit crops instead of grains to feed Chinese communities. I'm Jonathan Evans.
Zia Duetti's film, The Insult, has been nominated for an Academy Award for Best Foreign Language Film. The film explores the cultural, religious, and political divides that have existed in Lebanon since 1948. The story is rooted in a dispute between two men from different ethnic and religious backgrounds in Beirut, Lebanon. Through the film, Douairi shows a country he believes is broken because it has not dealt with its painful history. Beirut, Lebanon had a rough past, Douairi said. We had a lot of conflict with the Syrians, the Palestinians, the Lebanese, the left, the right, the conservatives, the liberals, the pro-West, the pro-East. Lebanon is such a tiny place, but it really absorbs all those kinds of things. He added, so, whenever you have that many conflicts and such a tiny place surrounded by so many countries, we are on a hotbed of problems. The Lebanese filmmaker said the effects of his country's civil war can still be felt. Things can get out of hand because since the end of the civil war, the Lebanese never sat down with each other to say, okay, the war is over, let's talk about it. There is stability, but it can explode any time, he said. The insult brings to life Lebanon's difficult political climate. Two men in Beirut have a small dispute. As the disagreement sharpens, it comes to represent a much larger problem. Tony is a Christian who works as a car mechanic. Yasser is a Palestinian. He heads a building project. A leaking pipe leaves Tony wet. Yasser fixes the pipe, only to see Tony destroy it. He is angry that a Palestinian came so close to his property. Yasser becomes angry too and insults Tony. Tony's pregnant wife tells Tony to let it end there. But Tony ignores the advice and goes to Yasser's employer. He demands that Yasser apologize and be fined for his behavior. Like most Palestinian refugees who live in Lebanon, Yasser does not have a work permit. His boss pressures him to apologize or face dismissal. When Yasser meets with Tony, their argument intensifies. This time, it is Tony who insults Yasser. Yasser hits Tony and breaks some bones. Tony takes legal action. Douairi said the idea for his film came from personal experience.
Just like the film starts, I was watering my plants. It's an old apartment, so the water leaked and fell on one of the construction workers. And he yelled because the water fell on him. And we had a heated exchange of words, and we ended up like yelling at each other.
Douairi said his argument was settled. Later, he said, he imagined what might happen if such a small incident was not settled. Could it develop into a national crisis in Lebanon, he wondered. In The Insult, the two men take the dispute all the way up to the country's Supreme Court. Douairi said his latest film has caused mixed reactions in Lebanon.
When the film came out, it split the country in a way because the Christian population flooded the movie and it became number one. But certain part, and I want to, just to be accurate, a certain part, a big part of the Muslim community boycotted the movie.
As a filmmaker, Douairi has been at the center of controversy before. His earlier film, The Attack, was banned in 22 countries, including Lebanon, because he had shot it in Israel. He said some Arab countries, including Jordan and the Palestinian territories, have also boycotted the insult. Duetti said his film offers a balanced study between Christian Lebanese and Muslim Palestinians. I'm Katie Weaver.
Daniel Turicini used to work long hours as a consultant in the Washington, D.C. area. He always felt tired by the middle of the workday. He asked business professionals if he knew what they did to feel more energetic during the day. Some told him they rested midday in their cars. Others said they took short naps at their desks. For Turicini, their answers revealed a need for Washington professionals, a place to go during the day to take a proper nap. So, a few months ago, he opened a nap cafe in the center of America's capital city. It is called Recharge. After turning off all of their electronic devices, Recharge customers lie down in so-called power nap cocoons. The cocoons are meant to help people fall asleep, stay asleep, and wake up feeling refreshed. They have a bed, a blanket, and a special scented eye mask to help customers relax. Soft music plays in the cocoons. The customers sleep for about 20 minutes before returning to work. Turicini says Recharge offers a solution to the city's fast-paced lifestyle, a chance to slow down. He says that today's professionals face issues that we never really had a generation ago. For example, smartphones make it easy for a boss or coworker to contact workers, in Turicini's words, at all hours at night or when you're on vacation. He says, "There's a load of other challenges we're facing today that wellness and lifestyle changes, habit changes, are critical to a sustainable life, to a long, happy life." Recharge experts also offer group sessions on meditation and mindfulness, as well as wellness events. Connor Garrity is an IT consultant. He says he visits Recharge almost every day. He says, "I feel, I guess, like the day is just beginning instead of thinking, oh my God, how am I going to get through the rest of the day? I come here a lot at the middle of the day and after work. And even that is just as helpful because you're energized." Maria Ponte is a lawyer in Washington. She says she often feels tired and stressed after hours of sitting down at work. She says, "What I like most about coming here is that I can breathe, whereas my morning is very crazy. I drink a lot of coffee, and I'm like moving too much too fast. So I come here. It helps stop time and just balance my day." I'm Jonathan Evans.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.